Welcome back to Radio Times. Back in the 1880s, only a small percentage of American workers had an office job working at what would be called non-manual labor. Clerks were a new occupation and had a lousy reputation, if some of the magazines at that time are to be believed. Vanity Fair said clerks were, quote, vain, mean, selfish, greedy, sensual, and sly, talkative and cowardly. Ouch. That's from Nikhil Saval's new book called Cubed, and it's about the history and evolution of the office and their impact on the work environment. He writes about how the dark, dank, all-male counting houses of the 19th century became the steno pool, became the cubicle, the open floor plan, the office campus with all the amenities. Our guest, Nikhil Saval, lives here in Philadelphia. He's an editor of N Plus One. Cubed is his first book, and it's nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're going to have to get used to this question. Can you describe an office place where you worked? I know you work at home now, but an office where you worked?
Yeah, so my office experience started straight out of college. I worked in a corporate publishing house, and it was very hierarchical. It was corridor offices along the side, and I had a cubicle right outside my boss's office, slightly labyrinthine, and it just felt, it was a 9-to-5 job. It was very straightforward, and to me, very fascinating. I had never had an office job before that, and I just loved pinning things to my cubicle walls. I loved like just kind of losing myself along the office and office gossip and all that. And then I moved actually after about a year, and I found another publishing house that was sort of more smaller, more precarious. My work hours were longer, and I had a smaller cubicle, and my back was to my boss's office, which was very frightening.
To have your back to your office.
Yeah, to have your back, because you sort of are just always peering.
When's the boss going to be peering over my
That's
shoulder?
That's right, exactly. I had to, and you know, that's really, I think it's when I moved that I really started to think that there was a topic here, that there was something to study about the office.
Well, what's so interesting is you take it to, I guess, these counting houses, and they seemed like both sort of bleak and dark. There wasn't a lot of lighting. People were looking at records and making computation. I mean, it seemed like a really difficult job, but everyone was kind of all close together, the clerks and the bosses.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these offices, the early counting houses, they came to be called offices sort of gradually. They were places of real, partly because they were all male, and because they were so small, they were just places of real bonhomie, just bonding. There was a sort of partnership between the bosses and the workers. There were just, you know, there would be a couple partners, and then just nearby in the same dark workspace, a clerk, a bookkeeper, you know, just a very sort of small group. And what that meant is that if you were a clerk, you saw your future right in front of you. Your boss was right next to you. You knew you could entertain expectations of high upward mobility. So in that sense, it was just a very convivial place. At least it certainly could be. And
depending on the boss, probably.
Depending on the boss, certainly. I mean, there's, you know, there are stories. Of course, one of the versions of this in fiction is Scrooge's office in A Christmas Carol, and that's not so cheery, at least not initially. And then also famously Bartleby the Scrivener, was set in an office of this kind.
Herman Melville's.
Yes, and that was not, that was sort of, that has become the paradigmatic like story of office drudgery from that time.
But why were clerks, I mean, I quoted from Vanity Fair, you also quote from Walt Whitman in your book. I mean, why were clerks so looked down upon and so frankly insulted, especially in the magazines of the time and even Walt Whitman?
Well, I think the attitude towards clerks at that time, it derived from a culture, an American culture that really prized manual labor, that saw itself as you know, in many respects, as a farmer's republic. And it was, you know, the economy was still largely agrarian. There were factories, but it had not reached the level that it would in the late 19th century. And there were always clerks. I mean, paperwork is sort of goes as far back as there's been paper.
Sure.
But in the 1850s, there was a real sort of rise in administration and bookkeeping. It was really felt that business needed more of these clerks. And this was suddenly this new kind of work that you couldn't ignore. And it didn't, it meant that you were really not producing anything. You weren't making anything. There was no craftsmanship. You just produced paper. You produced numbers. The work required very little physical activity except for the occasional lifting of a box or something like today. And the other kind of interesting thing is that you dressed, you didn't have work clothes. You basically wore what you wore on the street. You wore a white collar, often detachable, and that's where the term comes from. And that was just so odd to observers who did other kinds of work. They just thought, who are these people? They're thin, they're narrow chested, they're pale, they don't resemble any kind of worker we've ever noticed. And there was a sense that this was just unmanly. And this was deeply frightening to Americans at the time.
Well, even poet Walt Whitman, as you said, describing a slender and round-shouldered generation of minute leg, chalky face, and hollow chest, he goes on to say, what wretched spindling forked radishes would they be, and how ridiculously would their natty demeanor appear if suddenly they could all be stripped naked. The idea of seeing a naked clerk in all its sort of spindly whiteness.
Yeah, it was, well, for Whitman, it's funny because he, the poet of the multitude, the one creature he doesn't have, that one worker he doesn't have room for is the clerk.
Just he's the sort of reviled worker. And as you said, not manly enough, I guess.
Yeah, there's just, you know, it's just not, it just didn't count as real work. And there were a lot of magazines that exhorted workers to, one magazine exhorted workers to run into the countryside with their axe and just do real work, real men do real work. And there was just this, you know, the other fear is that at the time clerks, this changed later, but they did a lot of interaction with customers. There was a kind of very fluid relationship between clerks, and they were also dry goods salesmen. And so they would be bookkeepers, but then also sell clothes. And they interacted a lot with women. And so the fact of these sort of eunuch-like figures just interacting with women created a lot of sexual anxiety among Americans that has not really disappeared. That theme runs throughout the history of the office.
Well, that's interesting. And you also write about a guy named Frederick Taylor. Now, he wanted to change the office, and you also describe him as a, quote, odd duck. And there seem like there are a lot of odd ducks in this book, people wanting to reimagine the office. What made him so odd?
Well, Frederick Taylor, you know, a local person, worth pointing out, buried in Philadelphia, and he was a man that was probably no one before or since has been as obsessed with work and rationalizing work and efficiency as Frederick Taylor. He's one of the most significant figures, arguably, that the United States has produced. And his fascination came out of actually working in a factory himself. He came from a pretty upper-class family, but for various reasons, he failed his exams and couldn't enter Harvard, which was the main, you know, where he was supposed to go. And so he apprenticed himself in a factory. And it was when he was in a factory that he started to notice that the workers had very, according to him, lackadaisical work habits. They weren't being managed properly. They effectively controlled the work process themselves, and there was no sort of punching in and out, as we associate later with factory labor. And this infuriated Taylor. He just thought it was just unbelievably lazy. And as the further he rose in the ranks, because he was upper class, he could become a sort of manager at some point. The more and more he wanted to rationalize this process. He wanted to standardize tools, and above all, he wanted things to be efficient. And so he started to devise a system for making workers, rather than having them control the process, he would create a new class of managers who would draw up plans and which workers would follow, and above all, they would follow it to the clock. So in the main innovation that he introduced, that was the most reviled thing that he introduced, was the stopwatch.
Sure.
And he would time workers' motions because he always felt that it could be better done and more efficient.
You quote him as saying, it is only through enforced standardization of methods, enforced adoption of the best implements and working conditions, and enforced cooperation that this faster work can be assured. And the duty of enforcing the adoption of standards and enforcing this cooperation rests with the management alone. He uses the word enforced or enforcing quite a bit in those two sentences. That tells us a lot about Taylor.
Yeah, Taylor had no qualms about coercion of any kind.
Clearly,
and that I think is that people recognized it. There was no question that when Taylor started to introduce his system, workers didn't like being watched. They didn't know who they, you know, people would show up, and these were white collar workers as well, and they had never worked among them, and they would show up with their stopwatches, and they would be like, "Why are you? Who are you? Why are you watching me?" And so it just was this total intrusion into what was a situation of, compared with what came later, workers had a substantial measure of control over there. I mean, there was no intervening class of engineers or managers who were telling them how they should do their work. And so Taylor was not especially well liked by these workers. He was not
hard to imagine.
I mean, he was. I mean, in a way, he was not even well liked by a lot of his friends. He extended this to every process in his life. He invented a new tennis racket that was bent in the middle that he thought was more efficient for topspin. He invented a new golf club and he had a different kind of swing where he would stand on one leg and spring while he was swinging. And it actually didn't work very well, but he thought that only it was only a matter of time till the test proved him right. So he had a messianic quality to him that was not very attractive in his lifetime.
And can we thank him then for the manager? I mean, the creation and development of the manager in an office?
To a degree, yes. What he certainly created what you might call management theory. I think that there are sort of versions of it before, but he became the most successful exponent of it. There were manager-like figures, but he enlarged the stratum of managers immeasurably. And he, in his own lifetime, he was not initially successful. There was just so much, there was so much against him. And ultimately, it took a court case that was handled by Louis Brandeis, who later became a Supreme Court judge, who realized he got interested in the Taylor system. It was about, basically, to make a long story short, it was about railroad prices, and the railroads wanted to raise their prices. And Brandeis said, "No, I know this scientific management theory that suggests that railroads could be made more efficient. The efficiency is what's at issue." And overnight, Taylor woke up famous. Brandeis had made Taylor famous, and Taylor had by that point amassed a ton of acolytes. They used to meet in restaurants in New York and talk about management and the coming future of management and how utopian the future would be, but nobody believed them until this. And after that, it was great for Taylor, and the workplace changed immeasurably.
Taylorism was born. That's Nikhil Saval, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's called Cubed, and it's subtitled A Secret History of the Workplace. We are talking about white-collar workers and the office, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. Jefferson Orthopedics helps patients with hip, knee, foot, ankle, shoulder, and spinal problems and with sports injuries, and offers minimally invasive surgical procedures. Jefferson nurses and physical therapists employ post-operative rehab treatments designed to help patients resume their normal activities and lifestyle. To schedule an appointment or for further details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a Muslim tests the waters in Kentucky in a run for state senate.
Just because a lot of Republicans in my district does not mean they dislike me because of my Muslim background. They might dislike me because I'm a Democrat.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the American Philosophical Society Museum, presenting Jefferson, Philadelphia, and the Founding of a Nation. This exhibition explores Philadelphia through the lens of Jefferson as he wrote the Declaration of Independence and celebrates his long association with the city. Featuring his handwritten draft of the Declaration with edits and annotations, letters by Jefferson, Franklin, and others reference events leading to the writing of the Constitution. More information at apsmuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We all spend a lot of time at work, and the design of our workplace can have a big impact on how we think about our job, the people that we work with. And our guest, Nikhil Saval, has written a book about the history of the workplace, and it's called Cubed, based in part on those cubicles that we all know and partially love, I guess. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know about your workspace. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscow-Wain. As I said, we're going through history here, and so after Taylor, I guess we can jump to the idea of the steno pool, which in many ways looks like a big factory, and you've just got sort of lines of, in many ways, secretaries or clerks sort of one after the other sitting at their desk with their typewriter and possibly a telephone.
Yeah, so the steno pool, I mean, this in a way, this the arrangement of the steno pool, and everyone sort of knows this image. I think if they've seen The Apartment, that
sure.
great film, or the How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, or, of course, Mad Men now. What it comes out of is the attempt to make the office like a factory. I think when offices were really springing up, when business basically became big business and they needed more administration, the only precedent they had for a workplace was the factory, and they assumed office work would basically be like factory work. There was no concept of something called, you know, of knowledge work or things like that. And so what they did is they just decided that, well, managers needed offices, not necessarily because their work needed it, but because they had privilege, they had right. status, they had earned it. And the people who were doing the factory-like labor, the accounting or, you know, the typing or what have you, would be in the center. And that's where the stenographers, the typing pool, the steno pool was born. And one of the key changes, of course, between the sort of early clerical offices and, say, 1920 at the height of this kind of office space was the entry of women into the workplace.
Right.
And so all these steno pools were actually mostly full of women. They started to be hired in the 1860s, and then after a point, it really exploded. And so one also associates the steno pool with a sea change in the gender nature of the workplace as well.
You also describe, and it's interesting how certain pieces of either furniture or even technology can change the office. You write about the vertical file cabinet and how that really, in many ways, changed what work looked like.
Yeah, well, the file cabinet is funny. I mean, there are so many things where you just assume, well, surely we always had vertical filing, but actually it was not. It was not normal. Mostly files were horizontal, they were stuffed in your desk in a cubbyhole. It was really the concept of efficiency that drove the file cabinet. And, you know, the other thing that drove its shape was the increasing use of metal in the workplace. The more that skyscrapers began to spring up, which is a history in itself, the more the danger of fire was sort of threatened the workplace. This is what produced the metal waste basket, because people would throw out their cigarettes into their work waste baskets, and then people thought, we'll have these giant skyscrapers on fire. And the file cabinet made of steel was also part of this, and it actually mimicked the shape of the skyscraper. That was the other thing. And so you have figures like C. Wright Mills, the great sociologist who wrote one of the great books about white collar work, referring to the office as an enormous file.
Wow.
So there's a way in which the furniture started to reflect the shape of the workplace more generally.
Let's jump ahead to this guy named Robert Probst. And I guess in many ways, the cubicle that we associate with so many workplaces, I guess, begins with his thinking.
Yes. Poor Robert Probst, who the father of the cubicle. I don't think he ever wanted to be known that way.
Wasn't his intention, right?
No one wants to take responsibility for that. But yes, Robert Probst. So, he was hired by the Herman Miller Company, a furniture company, one of the sort of great purveyors of design in the workplace in the 1950s. And he was not a designer himself. He was just sort of a maniacally inventive thinker. He invented heart valve equipment. He just anything that kind of took his fancy. He sort of was like Taylor in that respect. That he saw things not working the way they should and wanted to fix them. And he was hired by Herman Miller to design something, furniture, they weren't sure what, but he was obsessed with the office, and that came out of his own work experience. He tried to set up a workspace for himself, and he realized that he kept changing the arrangement. He didn't want it to be like the arrangements they had prior. He, for example, one thing that he introduced was a standing desk. And this is now...
It seems very contemporary,
doesn't
it?
Yeah, it's all the rage now. Yes. Back then, it was idiosyncratic. I mean, people had sit-down metal and efficiency desks because they had all been standardized by Taylorists. And Probst realized that he would move from his standing desk to a sitting position and just sort of roam his space. And this made him more vital. It kept him alert throughout the day. And he began to just read voraciously in anthropology, behavioral science, and just was more interested in planning space than probably anyone up until that point had been. And he realized that offices had become sort of rote in that way. The way they were planned was not very imaginative. Someone had come up with the Steno pool, and they just reproduced that endlessly. And so he really considered the office workplace as he found it a wasteland, and he was determined to change it.
And to allow for some kind of movement within that space as opposed to just sitting at a desk and typing all day. Yeah. He's very smart, though, because you include a quote from him from The Office, a facility based on change. And he writes, "The caveman was undoubtedly very pleased to find a good cave, but he also undoubtedly positioned himself at the entrance looking out. Protect your back, but know what's going on outside is a very good rule for survival." And he also says, "It's also a good survival rule for life in the offices." I thought it's actually quite a brilliant thing to say.
Yeah, well, Probst was very attuned to, I mean, in a way that was a very smart way of connecting space and office politics, right? And hierarchy.
And anthropology.
And anthropology, yeah, yes. Exactly. Because he was just, he was such a wide reader and thinker in that vein. And again, and what you see in that quote in particular is his impulse to manage privacy and autonomy and also create a workspace that feels collective in some way. And this is where his furniture concepts came from.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where the cubicle came from, the idea of giving someone their own space and some degree of freedom within that space.
Exactly. And he had two attempts at this. And one was, they both were called the Action Office. The first one was beautiful. It was very loosely organized. It had the standing desk. It had multiple components. It was designed with another designer, George Nelson, who's one of the great American designers. And it was just too expensive. It was too loose. It didn't sell very well. So we went back to the drawing board, and then he came up with this system, which was three walls, fabric wrapped wood panels. And the idea was that it was supposed to be flexible. Like he saw the Steno pool and realized that you needed privacy and you needed autonomy, but also that you could change it. Because it was also the 1960s, and he had a certain... He was not immune. In fact, he was very influenced by the new concept of the individual, a certain new individualism in the air. He was very anti-bureaucratic. If you think of the critiques of bureaucracy from the 50s, the organization man, the man in the gray flannel suit, these were the sorts of things that Probst was trying to combat. And so the space was meant to be flexible for whatever kind of work could come up. He knew that computerization was happening. He didn't know what that would do, but he knew that the workplace was changing. And so it was not meant to be 90 degrees. It was meant to be 120 degrees. There were kits that came out with Action Office 2 where you could plan your workspace and change it, you know, accordingly. And when it did come out, it was received as a kind of revelation. It came out in 1968, a very... major year in all over the world, very revolutionary year. I don't think people associate it with the cubicle, but this is when it emerged. And, 25 years later, the design, it received a design award for the best furniture design of the last 25 years. But in those intervening years, people had copied it and people had turned it into a box. They had all those sort of principles that Probst had put behind it had been pretty easily ignored and pretty quickly ignored.
Well, in fact, you say that the cubicle began to shrink. I mean, what was sort of a place that you could call your own and put things on the walls and have some degree of privacy has gotten smaller over time.
Yeah, absolutely. It's in fact, there was a Business Week story that noticed this from the 90s, where they realized that their their cubicle, they wrote it because their cubicles were shrinking. And they said, why are cubicles shrinking? And it had shrunk from, you know, the hundreds of feet to something like 75 feet. And it, what that sort of started to feel like to the American worker was that their workspace was no longer, what that autonomy, that independence was actually, was not reflected in their workspace, that actually was a way for managers to cram them closer together. There was no real interest in workers' happiness or welfare, and that's with the cubicle.
But do you think that people have blamed the cubicle for that, or that managers sort of used the idea of the cubicle and somehow dehumanized work?
Well, it's a little of both, actually. I think in a way, the cubicle is not, it is sort of not, certainly in its 90-degree form, is not a great workspace, but I mean, it has problems with it. But I think the hatred of the cubicle really reflects a sort of hatred of what had happened to work at that point. I think, and it really, the Dilbert atmosphere comes about in the late 80s and 90s when layoffs became more common in the workplace, and mergers and acquisitions meant that more and more people were crammed into bigger and bigger buildings and just bigger and bigger spaces, but with more larger companies. And so this was what the cubicle started to reflect, a more precarious work environment. And so rather than being autonomous and independent, you felt it as flimsiness, transience. That's I think what it started to represent. And so when people talk about cubicle hatred, in a way it's code for what they think about their workplace.
It felt more like a cell than a place you could call your own.
Exactly.
And that's Nikhil Saval, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Believe it or not, we're talking about the history of the workplace, how the cubicle got created. And he writes about this in his new book called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We want to know about your workplace. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coame. Let me get Tom from, looks like Malvern, to join our conversation. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my
You're
call.
You're welcome.
I worked for and still work for an engineering company, and I've worked for a lot of large engineering companies in the city of Philadelphia. And it's interesting over the years, the way that the office was set up is that the managers in that office got the offices themselves that had the windows, and the junior engineers actually received the cubicle. So it was more of a hierarchy setup, and still is today. I mean, I would imagine a lot of companies are perhaps set up that way as well, with a limited space in the city of Philadelphia.
Well, Tom, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And you, Nikhil, you write about sort of hierarchy, and there have been attempts in some offices to have, for instance, no bosses, that everyone's sort of on an equal plane. But over time, somebody or somebody's kind of rise to the top, and a hierarchy is created.
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
It's so the workplace in some ways, I mean, the very traditional workplace is so transparently hierarchical. I mean, in the way that it's, I mean, even when we talk
about who gets what office, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the aspirational nature. It's meant to be, the workplace is meant to be, in its ideal form, meritocratic. You can rise from the cubicle to the corner office. And in fact, the original open plan, which is now all the rage in offices, was invented in the 1950s in Germany. It was called the office landscape, and that was meant to precisely to eliminate hierarchies based on space requirements. And there were no private offices. You had sort of like, it was meant to just in, like you could just work. And it was not very orthogonal. It was not the Stenopool rows of desk. It was just very fluid in the room. But you do actually have hierarchy popping up. I mean, managers would actually create informal offices by giving themselves screens or an extra plant or two. The other thing is hierarchy doesn't disappear when you just take away offices. It just sort of persists in a more subtle form.
There's an article, I don't know if it's the New York Times or somewhere, about an agency or an idea of having one gigantic desk. Yeah. And everyone working around a desk. I mean, it's hard to imagine that would be an effective way to work, but I guess it depends on the kind of work involved.
Yeah, that's the super desk.
The super desk, exactly.
That Clive Wilkinson designed. It's you know, it remains to be seen whether that's effective or gimmicky. But I think that there is a way in which that sort of thing advertises the company. I mean, the a lot of offices have been designed to outwardly in a certain way. I think Google in particular is one of these offices where we actually all have a sense that Google or places like that have wacky offices with food all the time and, you know,
climbing walls,
exactly, a resistance pool, volleyball court. And I mean, these are of course for the workers themselves, but it's meant to suggest something about the company, and the company is meant to imply something to its workers that we're all equal here. We all work in the same place. And I mean, I'm a little bit skeptical, I confess. I think this super desk might be a pretty distracting place to work.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, we've all tried to work it. It's like a big picnic table in some ways. Very, very beautiful, though, I have to say.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But speaking about Google, and one of the things that you also say in the book is that by having all these amenities, including, you know, a food court and volleyball and a climbing wall and yoga classes, is it keeps people at work. I mean, it has this sort of inverse impact on the worker, which is, well, maybe it's not so inverse. They want to be there.
Yeah, you know,
or it's hard to leave.
It's hard to leave. It doesn't give you a great cause to leave. I mean, you can go to the doctor. You know, you can just do most of the things that you would have to leave the office for, like lunch. You just don't have to do, and that's based on a certain idea that people are more productive at work. I think certainly the people at Google think that, and that's why they want to keep them there. And then also a notion that is very prevalent in office design and has been for a little while that you might run into someone at the office that you wouldn't if you were working from home. I mean, offices really have to justify themselves now because there's a lot of work doesn't need to be done there, and you don't have to because of technology, but one of the justifications is this notion of this so-called serendipitous encounter, where you might, and Google is arranged this way, other offices are arranged this way, where you have long corridors and you might just be walking along to go to the bathroom or to go to the cafeteria, and you'll run into someone from another department and you know, have a conversation that might over time lead to something new. And at least this is the theory of how it works. And I think that's why a lot of these companies make their offices so homey or campus-like.
Well, and we're almost having a break here, and one could see the pros and cons. I mean, it would be great to go to the doctor and do all the things that you have to do after work to do it at work, but then the idea of never leaving seems a little worrisome, to say the least.
Right, and it just seems, you know, in places where you have cities, I mean, like Google's pretty not far from San Francisco, it seems a little odd. A lot of these places don't provide those services, right. And so it makes it can depopulate the areas around you.
Well, they're the Google buses, right? That pick everyone up in San Francisco.
Right, that's right.
That's Nikhil Saval, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the evolution, the history of the office, the workplace, the subject of his new book called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Widener University School of Law. A Juris Doctor degree from Widener Law is designed to help you to start your legal career with confidence. Both campuses in Wilmington, Delaware and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania offer flexible scheduling, with full and part-time classes allowing you to earn your Juris Doctor degree on your time. Specialized certificate programs are also offered to help you develop expertise in specific fields of law. More information at WidenerULaw.com. That's WidenerULaw.com.
On the next Fresh Air, a legal battle in the fight for marriage equality. We talk with New York Times reporter Joe Becker, author of Forcing the Spring. Her book focuses on the challenge to California's Proposition 8, which brought together former legal opponents Ted Olson and David Boies, who argued on behalf of gay marriage in state appeals and the Supreme Court. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The importance of eye contact in the matter of extinction.
If the future of the planet depends on everybody, you know, looking into the eyes of a Sumatran rhino, then I'm afraid we're in trouble. There are just too few of them left.
Being at the front lines of planetary mass extinction is an emotional place for New Yorker writer Elizabeth Colbert. Thoughts for Earth Day next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. So do you work in a cubicle or an open shared space or at a great big table or at a sprawling office campus? Do you have one of those prize corner offices? Or perhaps you're at home on your computer, at your kitchen table, or in your studio like Jean, who just tweeted us. We spend a lot of time at work, and the design of our workplace can have a big impact on how we think about what it is that we do. Our guest Nikhil Saval decided to investigate the history and evolution of the office and white-collar jobs in his book. Is called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And like Janine, you can tweet us at Marty Moss Coaim. Let me get Mark from Bucks County to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just thinking of 25 years ago, I worked in the Sears Tower in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And Sears had a policy that when you were promoted, you didn't necessarily have to move. They changed the office. They could expand, push out the walls, and you would get an upgrade of furniture. So they just, you stayed where you were, but if you got a new job, the job, if it was a promotion, you would get an upgrade.
And
you would literally just move the walls.
And move the walls to make a bigger and I guess, a more luxurious space. Mark, that's very interesting. Nikhil, what do you think?
Well, it's great that the workspace was so flexible. And actually, I think the Sears Tower, that was designed, the furniture was provided by Steelcase. So like one of the companies that really thinks a lot about the workplace. I think the funny thing about furniture and promotions is that, you know, it isn't necessarily rational that workers, entry-level workers, would have the worst workspaces in the office. I mean, you should have a workspace that depends on the kind of work that you do. And it's not clear. In a perfect world. And so it seems like it would be, what really would make sense is if, and I think this is actually changing right now, is if your workspace actually reflected the kind of work that you had to do. If it was very concentrated private work, maybe you need a private office, or maybe you need it for a day or two. And but flexibility is definitely an important part of the workplace.
You actually write about a Dutch insurance company called Interpols.
They
seem very forward thinking, created this thing called Tivoli Plaza.
Yeah. So
space.
Interpolis was a very, it was designed by a Dutch designer who's very famous in the very fervent small world of design, office design, called Erik Veldhoen. And he realized pretty early on that technology was changing the capabilities of a workplace. And so in the 90s, Interpolis was going through a kind of downturn. And he was hired to redesign the space. And what he did is he created what you could call a non-territorial office. And that basically meant that you didn't have a permanent desk, that you could you would come in and you would have, they would offer laptops, were sort of new at that time, and a phone they would also give you, and you had a locker, and you would just find a space where you needed to work. And they had multiple floors. I mean, the main plaza is sort of it's a cafeteria area. It has many different kinds of designs. It's very, very pretty and meant to just, depending on the kind of collaborative work you have to do. But mostly what they did is they created a lot of permanent offices for people. So if they need a permanent office, they could go in and work there. On the other hand, they didn't actually have to come in to work every day. It was sort of decided by teams. If you needed to be there, you would be there. But from what I gathered, people come in, I'd say 3 to 4 days a week, and then 1 to 2, they work from home, or they leave early, you know, if they have to pick up a child from work or something. So it was, in that sense, it was very forward-thinking, and some things are starting to happen here in the U.S., but they were sort of more advanced
in
the Netherlands.
And do they still exist, and has it been successful, and are they
still exist, and they've really influenced the Dutch workplace more generally. I mean, you know, it's also helps that it's just a social democratic ethos out there, and there's a high emphasis on worker welfare. And so, but a lot of companies have now, like Microsoft in the Netherlands actually works on the same, at least in, there's an office near Amsterdam that works that way. The Dutch government, some of their tax offices have actually shifted to this model. So it's changing a lot over there. And that was, yeah, it's become hugely influential.
Let me get Joshua from Society Hill in Philadelphia to join us. Joshua, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, yeah, so my question is about kind of the physical setup of cubes and if you've done any work on how that impacts offices. I worked in an investment bank where we had kind of cubes that were, you could see over if you stood up, but sitting down you were kind of isolated. We then moved offices to much lower walled cubes where you could kind of have a conversation with the person opposite you while still sitting. And it kind of, it changed everything from the way we ate lunch to, you know, what was acceptable when people were working, when you could talk to them. And I'm just wondering if you've looked into anything in terms of the physical setup and layout and height.
That's interesting, Joshua. Yeah, go ahead, Nikhil.
Yeah, it definitely does have an effect. And I think actually the trend you describe, Joshua, of the walls coming down is a trend. Because there is a new emphasis at the moment on collaboration. And again, though, it does depend on the kind of work that you have to do. I think investment banks in particular often, I mean, trading desks, and like they in some ways they've often resembled newsrooms. They've required a lot of buzz and they encourage that kind of just orchestrated chaos in the workplace. But it can also be harmful depending on the kind, if you have work that requires concentration, an open plan office of that kind or low partition space can be incredibly distracting, and it can, you know, adds visual noise. I mean, you might just look up from your desk and stare into someone's eyes. That can be very existentially upsetting. And so it can be beneficial, but the key I found is that you need to make room for private space and for private work, if you do a lot of that work.
And that is the challenge of the office, which is to create some degree of privacy for people to do the things that they need privacy for, but also to be able to interact with other people as well. It's, as you say, this has been a challenge for office designers over the decades, really.
Yeah, and it's become a lot more, it's become a lot of a bigger topic, certainly in the contemporary era. I think the long experience of the office cubicle, which guaranteed neither privacy nor collaboration, has led to a lot of just changes in the workplace. Not all of them for the better, but some of them. And the open plan to encourage more collaboration is one of them. But again, privacy can be a casualty of it.
Isn't there a phrase called something like prairie dogging, or when people in their cubicles all at the same time jump up to see what's going on, and these heads kind of appear above the walls of the cubicle?
Yes. Yeah. It's a very. I think everyone knows that phenomenon. If they've worked in a cubicle, if the walls are too high, you suddenly have this head peering over, and that's
exactly.
that is known as prairie dog. Yeah.
I was thinking about the TV show The Office, and as I was obviously reading your book and preparing for the interview, and thinking about the fact that they never did a lick of work in the office. I mean, it was so fascinating to me, just as a show, but also to thinking about how their desks were set up and who was next to whom and who was off in the corner.
Yeah, the office, there are many versions of it, of course, now, and they're just about the weird social dynamics of the office. And that's not inaccurate. It's, you know, there's this also a joke from Office Space where the character just says, I only do actually about 15 minutes of work a week. He's just mostly zoning out and socializing or whatever. And it's true that offices are often just, I mean, that's probably their biggest justification, is that they're social, especially when we feel now that you can, if you have work that requires concentration, you may not be best suited for an office. So it's not It's not wrong. It's a little odd. I mean, it's amazing how they managed to keep their jobs in that
exactly.
show.
Exactly. I always scratch my head about that. Again, you can give us a call. We'd love to know about your office space. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. It is interesting to talk about the history of the office, knowing how many more people either work at home or they're part-time workers, or they're temporary workers, or they're freelance workers. The world of work seems to be changing so much, which has got to put some pressure on what an office could or should be.
Absolutely. And this is, in a way, we're going through a very prolonged change in the nature of what used to be stable middle-class employment. And one of the most visible phenomena is the rise of freelancing or contract work. And it's very hard to measure, but I mean, an expert I spoke to who has studied this, Richard Greenwald, estimated about 20-30% of workers now are freelancers primarily, you know, and or contractors. And you can see the results in cities. I mean, just people, not a lot of people working in cafes or just anywhere in a train station or where have you, what have you, are not permanent employees. And they have sort of gigs that they're doing. And a lot of this is not their choice exactly. I mean, since the 70s, the workforce has just become more casual or informal. And so it can be a very insecure, anxiety-inducing situation. But you can also, some people do choose. And to the extent that there is an element of choice, one of the manifestations of this is the rise of a co-working facility, which some people may be familiar with even from their own lives. There's a very interesting one here in Philadelphia called Indy Hall in Old City. And that's for people who, the weird thing about it is you would think that people who don't have to work in an office wouldn't. I mean, just
stay at home.
They'd
right?
stay at home. But it turned, the rise of these facilities suggests something different, that people do actually need something. They need, or at least they seek it, at least that they seek some kind of sociability or culture just to be around other people. And at places like Indy Hall, they don't actually work all day, but they'll come in, you know, every so often, and they'll even pay for a desk. I think that's sort of an astonishing thing.
Let me get Liz from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Liz. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm kind of in a unique situation. I'm the manager of a marketing department. We do a lot of calling. We also do a lot of social media event preparation, kind of unique and creative work. So I'm faced with the situation of moving my team from an office with low wall cubicles and windows to a room with no windows and high cubicle walls. I was given the option maybe to tear them down, cut them, how I could work with this space. I thought maybe change the lighting, and I wanted to get your feedback and see if you have any recommendations.
Well, Liz, I can tell you only because as Nikhil made a terrible face when you described the possibility of moving to a place with high walls and no windows. Go ahead, Nikhil.
Certainly, the no windows is a real problem. You know, it's funny that there's in certain countries they have regulations on light that you're supposed to, in Germany for a while. I don't know if it's still true, but that you had to be near a light source. So that's too bad. But I think the real thing that you have to guarantee in a workspace like that, especially when people are making a lot of calls, is to shield people from each other's conversations. And this is something that a cubicle office has not often been good at. This is true whether you're an open plan or not. And so, I mean, I'm not really a designer, but I would just suggest that you find ways to make room for privacy, and you find ways to make room to take calls or to make calls in a phone booth. Or I've seen, you know, lots of companies arrange situations like that. So if there's any way to kind of add in sound screens, just mufflers to make people, to ensure that they have some level of privacy to do their work.
And think about what a window, I guess, offers a workspace as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Liz, thanks for the call. Let me get Chris from Ambler to join us. Hi, Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'd appreciate if your guests would comment on two innovative office ideas I have heard about. One was when Steve Jobs returned to Apple, he changed the location of bathrooms to be in one central area on each floor, forcing the employees to cross-pollinate their ideas and their skills as they met in that central area to go to and from the restrooms. And the other innovative idea is the CEO of Costco and Mayor Bloomberg, and there's probably a few others, who decided to locate their desk in the center of a big room and have the other employees at various desks extending, you know, toward the edges of the room. And their intention was to make themselves approachable by other employees and to signify that there wasn't there was not a hierarchy, you know, a value of the employee.
Well, Chris, I appreciate the call. Nikhil, we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye.
Oh, sure. Well, let me just address the first one quickly. The Steve Jobs story is fascinating because, yes, it's true that Jobs, when he was designing Pixar, wanted to locate the bathrooms in the center of the space, just two bathrooms in particular. But it turned out, actually, he was stymied by his architects, and I think for good reason. It turns out that when you actually are running 15 minutes to go to the bathroom, the last thing you have on your mind is interacting with someone else. and so the actual current design of Pixar has about, I think, eight. I'm not totally sure of that. Right. But, yeah, so that can be a sort of extreme idea of what people do in a workplace, that they're not actually always interacting, that they have basic needs that need fulfilling, that I think that kind of design doesn't allow for.
And the CEO in the middle, briefly?
The CEO in the middle, I think it's a tremendous gesture to do that. It does mean that people are more approachable. I mean, that didn't stop Bloomberg from flying to Bermuda any chance he got, but it did mean that. You know, it doesn't, I again want to emphasize that space alone doesn't eliminate hierarchies. Eliminating hierarchies eliminates hierarchies. So,
well, Nikhil Saval, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And the book is titled Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. You can catch up with him on May 20th. He'll be speaking at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Also go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, email, and the archives. That's whyy.org/Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us. And do